Good morning, everybody. Though it's still a bit early, I'm very happy to announce our first speaker, Ranulfo Romo. He is professor of neuroscience at the Autonomous University, National University of Mexico, which usually runs under the name of UNAM. So let's stick to that. He received his medical doctor degree from UNAM and his doctor of science in Paris, and then did postdoc work with Wolfram Schulz at the University of Fribourg, so that's Switzerland, and then with Vernon Mountcastle at Johns Hopkins. It's my great pleasure to announce your talk, Lo and Behold. He stuck to the title he had suggested, but nevertheless, even if you would have changed it, we are very curious to hear about conversion of sensory signals into perceptual decisions. Please.
Good morning to everybody. I think you can hear me. Thanks for your kind introduction. And of course, I'm very grateful to the organizing committee for inviting me to come here, and particularly to Andreas Hertz. I think the title of my talk is no more than my hope, really what I want to understand. For over 25 years, I've been interested in trying to understand how a sensory representation in the brain gives rise to a perceptual decision. You can see it's a very simple problem in words, but it's not as easy as I thought many years ago, because first, you want to understand how the sensory stimulus is encoded in the activity of brain cells, which is of the domain of sensory physiologists. And secondly, quite often, that sensory representation is combined with experience, which is a stored memory. And I think from there, it comes a decision, and this decision needs to be expressed to voluntary actions. So I will address these three problems in, I think, 35 minutes, I hope. And if not, I will stop. The chairman will warn me to stop. And most of these problems have been addressed using the visual system as a model. I'm not an eccentric man. I will use the somatosensory system to address this problem. I think few people have been used this sensory modality. But for certain historical reasons, I will use it because, first, because I was trained by Vernon Mountcastle, and when I was with him, I realized that he and I had different views about this problem. And when I went back to Mexico City, I thought, I was younger than I am right now, I thought I could address much better than him, as you can imagine, for a young man. So the structure of my talk will be very simple. In the first part of my talk, I will explain to you the behavioral tasks that I use in my laboratory. And in the second part of my talk, I simply will document. I think most of the speakers have already addressed all the theory about sensory perception, decision making, and all this, working memory, etc. And which in my laboratory, some of my colleagues like Gustavo Deco, Carlos Brody, Xiao Jing Wang, some other have addressed the computational properties related to this task. So, this is a cartoon of the monkey that we use. It's a rhesus monkey sitting in a monkey chair, which is not seen here. And as I said, I use the somatosensory system as a model. So the left arm and forearm and hand are restrained in a cast which does not compress the muscles and blood vessels and nerves. It's simple. The monkey learns to stay for hours like this, so the monkey cannot pull the arm back or forward, and the hand is up, so that the skin can be easily stimulated by hand or by the mechanical stimulators. Monkeys do not speak, so this fellow will use this key, which is a very simple electronic device, and a couple of push buttons to tell me what is thinking about and about the processing of the sensory stimuli delivered to the skin. At a given moment, the proof moves very, very fast in the air, and in about 100 milliseconds touches the skin. It's a very gentle indentation of the skin, and activate cutaneous mechanoreceptors. And in response, there is a train of activity that travels very fast through the cutaneous nerves, go to the upper part of the spinal cord, then to the thalamus, and then to the cerebral cortex. So the monkey will use this sensory representation to react very quickly, and in about 200 milliseconds, which is the reaction time in response to this stimulus, places his hand in this key. And the question for me, I always thought about this, there is this simplest stimulus reaction that produces a voluntary action. What is the neural mechanism associated to this? And I challenge to anybody here in this room whether they can give me a biophysical explanation about how this simple touch representation in the cerebral cortex drives the motor circuits in the frontal lobe. In spite of this, I will continue. So this, the stimulus is on the skin, is indenting permanently, the hand is on the key, and then it comes superimposed a vibration which lasts 500 milliseconds and is in the flutter range. So from trial to trial, it can vary from 10 to 40 hertz. So the animal never knows what is the stimulus, what is the frequency delivered on as the first stimulus. Then stimulator stops, and after a gap, it comes another second stimulus. And for you, it's very easy to see that there are more pulses than here. It lasts exactly the same 500 milliseconds. It's simply that there is a variation in comparison to this. So the monkey has to pay attention to the first stimulus, and I guess, and I think there is something stored in the brain about the first stimulus, and then when the second comes, the monkey has to pay attention again, and then make a very simple mental operation whether the second stimulus is higher than the first. And for you, it's very easy to say, of course, to realize that it's higher than the first. And if the monkey says correctly, then the second is higher, which is the case, releases the key, and we push the lateral push button, and in response to this, we'll receive a reward. So this is what the monkey does. In some other trials, we have exactly the same sequence, task sequence, and we request again whether the second stimulus is higher than the first. The monkey says correctly no, and will release the key and press the medial push button, and because it's correctly said, we'll receive drops of apple juice. Sometimes I think it's tequila or something like that. Okay, this is what the monkey does for hours in the laboratory, and you might wonder whether there is something interesting about this task. What I have in this graph is here in the horizontal axis, I have the frequencies about the first stimulus, the base, or F1, and in the vertical axis, we have the second stimulus, which is the comparison one. And in the boxes, I have numbers, which is the percentage of correct responses. And you can see, for example, if the first stimulus is 20 and I vary the second, so for the monkey, it's very easy to say that it's higher than 20 and then 10 is lower than 20. Numbers decrease to a point when 20 is 20, the first, and the second is 20, the monkey is simply guessing, 0.5 for probability. And I can do exactly the opposite. I can keep fixed the second stimulus and vary the first one, and you can see, again, we have the high percentage here, but the numbers decrease. I can take these values, which are here, and I can plot them, and graph as a psychometric function, which is simple as the percentage of that the second stimulus is called higher than the first one, which is about here. So again, the monkey always says that 30 is higher than 20, and then 10 is lower than 20, and difficulties for the animals are just in the middle. I can have the discrimination threshold, which is by taking the 75% of the upper limb and the 25% of the lower limb, and divided by two, I have the discrimination threshold that for the monkey, for this monkey, is about 2.6 hertz. The beauty of this task is that this curve, the green one, comes from a human primate. This is me. And you will see that the discrimination threshold is about higher, 2.9. I always think that with some more training, I could be almost similar to the monkey. This immediately tells us to you that the simplicity of this task is very interesting for addressing the discrimination capabilities of the two primates. And very likely, the same neural structures are very similar for achieving discrimination performance. Now, what are the questions? If you follow me, you already know what are the questions. And the first question is, for the first stimulus at least, is the representation of the stimulus frequency. So the only what matters for the animal is the frequency, because with some controls we can make, in spite of the differences in frequencies, that the two stimuli are judges of the same amplitude. And so I want to think that what matters here is the frequency. And because the simplicity of the stimulus, you can try to understand how this stimulus frequency is encoded in the activity of brain cells. The second question is, once the stimulus is gone, something has to be stored in the brain. And the question is, where and how in the brain? And of course, this question is for the people interested in the neural mechanism associated with working memory. And the third one, which is the most interesting one, at least for me, once the second stimulus comes here, this must be compared about the memory trace left by the first stimulus. And the question again is, where and how in the brain these two processes are combined to produce a decision signal that is translated to the motor circuits to generate a decision motor report. So the three questions I will try to address in the remaining time, the three questions. So the first, how the stimulus is encoded in the activity of brain cells. The second is, where in the brain information is stored about this stimulus, and where in the brain the two are combined to produce a decision signal. So this is the monkey brain, one of the brains of the that had been studied in the laboratory. And again, this fellow have two hemispheres, as we do, and have a central sulcus. I'm using the somatosensory system. So the first question is, I guess that the first question has to be posed at the level of the somatosensory cortex. And because the stimulus is delivered in the hand, we can go with some precision where is the territory, the brain, the cortical territory where information is processed from each of the fingers. In this case, this is the territory for processing information coming from the fifth finger, the fourth, the third, the second, and one. We normally work with these three fingers, these four fingers, and not with the first one. So the first question is whether with the somatosensory cortex is enough for achieving discrimination of the task. So, which means that not only the sensory input is encoded in the activity of somatosensory cells, cortical somatosensory cells, but also that this cell might have the capability of storing information about the first stimulus and eventually combining the sensory and the stored signal. And of course, producing a decision signal that drives the frontal motor circuits. Okay, Anatomies have done a very nice job, and all these can be reduced to the stimulus, which to the fingers, the mechanoreceptors, and then the primary afferents that end in the spinal cord, in the upper part of the spinal cord, the thalamus, and then the cortical territory, where we know with some precision where the sensory input ends, at least in the primary somatosensory cortex. And anatomies and physiologists have described not only the place, but also the submodality is represented in the activity there. And also there are columns associated to the mechanical receptors, Merkel's, which are slowly adapting receptors, and rapid adapting, which are associated to Merkel corpuscles. So easily, you can insert your microelectrodes either in the slowly adapting or rapid adapting columns, and the space is under control. So you know with some precisions where to deliver the stimulus and where in the cerebral cortex to do the recordings of the cortical cells as the monkeys, and the monkeys are performing the task. So now I'm going to show you a single trial and the whole sequence of the task. So in response to the gentle skin indentation, there is a burst of activity of the cell, which is recording the cerebral cortex. The stimulus is delivered in the center of the receptive field. And then when the first stimulus comes, normally these neurons are entrained by the stimulus frequency. You can see how nicely they are. And when the second stimulus comes again, they are entrained by this activity. And when you remove the stimulus from the skin, the neuron responds again. This is a very, very typical, quickly adapting response cell of the cerebral cortex. And if you do repeat exactly the same stimulus, the two stimuli, you will see that there is almost the same stimulus response for these brain cells. But the question here is very simple of what's happened here. Okay? Is the neural code, which was already addressed during this meeting. One possibility, imagine that somebody is sitting in the cerebral cortex and has no access to the stimulus delivered to the skin. So the only information that can get is the stimulus responses, just by looking the responses there. And one possibility, of because of the simplicity of the responses, is that this fellow is paying attention to the interval, the spike intervals delivered by the rigidity of the stimulus. And we would call this time one, because if the fellow will take this, it will be exactly the same. And when the second stimulus comes, we'll take exactly the same logic. You see that this interval is shorter than this one. And as the donkey does, it could use this very simple rule. If time one is higher than time two, then the second stimulus frequency is high. And when we did these experiments in the late 80s, we came to the conclusion that the difference in period length is the cortical neural discriminandum in frequency discrimination at the level of the postcentral gyrus of the somatosensory cortex. And we said, in a very bold way, that we conclude that the periodic code is adequate for frequency discrimination, but we never did a control. So if this periodicity were important for solving the task, this means that if I destroy this, the sequence, the periodicity, but keeping exactly the same frequency, the observer would be confounded and not being able to do the discrimination. But, as you can see, the monkey had no difficulties. The discrimination performance is practically identical when the stimulus is periodic. So the question is, what are the neural signals that an observer might use in order to solve a task? So again, doing the experiments, this is the first stimulus. The first stimulus is 20, and the second varies from 30 to 10. But if you do more recordings across the different layers of the primary somatosensor of a column, for example, you might get this. Neurons that have exactly the same cutaneous responses, but when you deliver the stimulus to the skin, what you see is simple. The periodic stimulus is that the neuron is simplified. And of course, If you deliver the aperiodic stimulus to the skin that the monkey is able to discriminate, there is no way that this observant might use the spike intervals in order to solve the discrimination task. So at this moment, I have shown to you the discrimination task, the task, and the problem posed at the sensory level for the discrimination, but the neural discrimination. So the next question that I address myself is just simple, just comparing the cell discrimination performance against the animal discrimination performance simultaneously. And for this, what I use first is the spike intervals. And with this, you can produce two responsive distributions for the first and for the second stimulus, just simply by using a signal detection theory. I will not enter. I'm sure that all of you are aware of this and know quite well these techniques. But with this, you are able to get a neurometric curve, which is the yellow one here, against the animal discrimination performance. And you can get, again, the discrimination threshold for the neuron and for the animal. And what happens, the threshold ratio for this, is that most of the cells are much better than the animal discrimination by using these metrics. Sometimes it's 10 times or 20 times much better, and this might pose some questions about the neural code. But if you use the very simple metric, which is the firing rate, and again you do two responsive distributions, you can get another neurometric curve from the same response, now using the firing rate, and you can see that the shape and the discrimination and the threshold ratio, that is the discrimination of the neuron plus against the discrimination of the monkeys, very close to one, which means that there's very close correspondence. And of course, the only metric that you can use when the stimulus is aperiodic is the firing rate, and again, the neurometric curve, the shape, is very, very similar to the animal discrimination curve. And by plotting the threshold ratio of the animal versus the neuron, you see that they are very close to one. So the conclusion is very simple, a very simple firing rate might suffice to this observer to solve the discrimination task. So in this case, the periodic signal might not be used by this fellow to do the discrimination. But this is only a correlation. The next question we address ourselves is that by taking advantage of the simplicity of this neural code, with the same microelectrode which is inserted, which is mapping the activity coming from the fingers, we decided to insert very simple, weak current pulses in the neurons that are mapping the information coming from the fingertips. And again, the task sequence is the first stimulus is natural, delivered to the fingers, and the second can be mechanical or can be electrical at the comparison frequency. And what we got is this, is that the discrimination performance, which is the green one, when you substitute the second stimulus by the electrical currents delivered to the cortex, is the psychometric curve is practically identical. And of course, if you substitute the stimulus by aperiodic stimulus, but at the comparison frequency, the curve is practically similar to the one elicited by the natural stimulus. And of course, you can apply this protocol. You can substitute the first stimulus by current pulses. And remember, it needs to be stored in the network in order to be compared to the second. And again, the curve is very similar. And very often, we substitute the two stimuli, so the monkey never knew what we were doing, but these are the discrimination performance. There are some differences between the two curves, but believe me or not, the green one is much better than the one produced by the natural stimulus. So this simply tells you that the bulk activity by the sensory stimulus is used by the network for discrimination, and that if you bypass this information by artificial activation of the neurons, you might activate the whole network in order to produce discrimination, to store this information in somewhere in the brain, and to do the comparison. So the second problem is this one, is once the first stimulus is gone, in somewhere in the brain has to be stored this information in order to be compared against the second stimulus. Of course, most of the work in memory studies has been done using the visual system as a model. So when we started these experiments, we didn't know where to go. So we were across the whole brain. And of course, we knew that that primary somatosensor cortex didn't care about this. But we tried secondary ventral motor cortex, where Rizzolatti has described the mirror cells. And of course, the classical area, the prefrontal cortex, below the principal sulcus. And even this area with the medial premotor cortex, which comprises the supplementary motor area and the premotor supplemental cortex, and even the primary motor cortex and some other circuits here. But I'm not going across this. I will simply show you three examples. This is the first one, a typical response for the primary somatosensory cortex. You will see that it's driven as a function of the stimulus frequency, but the point here is that these neurons are not modulated during the waiting period, which is the time when the animal must keep something in working memory in order to do the comparison when the second stimulus comes here. This neuron comes from secondary somatosensory cortex, and when we found this, we were very surprised, because if you are not sleepy yet, you will see that this neuron does exactly the opposite here. So it's tuned in a negative fashion. So when we found that, we were very much surprised, but of course we have the typical neurons that are driven like this. Have no time for this, but what these neurons do, the two circuits, the two populations of neurons which are there, are doing a subtraction operation, and the fraction is correlated with the psychophysical performance. And this neural code is kept for the next of the circuit for the working memory component and for the decision component. This neuron comes from prefrontal cortex, and Druckmann said yesterday, persistent neurons are very few in the network, but they are about 10% of the neurons do. Most of the neurons do in the early part, on the middle, or in the last component. But what is beautiful here, you can see that this neuron is really discriminating the difference in frequency in a very similar manner as here, but once the stimulus is gone. And of course, you have the neurons that do exactly the opposite. This neuron comes from the medial premotor cortex, and what is beautiful here is that the neuron responds just as delayed, very similar like here, but it's tuned in a negative fashion. You have exactly the opposite neuron. So the network is managed to keep the information in a parametric way and in different times, and it's very nice to know. And I think that they are sharing efforts in order to solve the discrimination task. And in the last 5 minutes, I will address the last part of my talk. And I will try to introduce how we address this. It's a difficult problem because from the same activity, you should be able to decode information, for example, during the second stimulus, information about what was introduced as the first stimulus and what is in the second stimulus, and a combination of two. And the way we did this is simple. We take the firing rate, and you will see and plot as a function of the stimulus, the first stimulus or the second stimulus in this case, and you have a very positive monotonic modulation of this neuron, and got a coefficient which is an index of the modulation as a function of the stimulus frequency. But you can do exactly the same just by taking information about the first stimulus by using information of delivered by the second, produced by the second stimulus, and plot in a planar fit as it is. So remember that coefficient can be now for the first stimulus positive or negative for the first, and positive and negative for the first. And if there is a comparison signal, this has to be combined. So just by doing this simple analysis, you will see that this neuron is really sensory. Is driven by the second stimulus, not by the first. But in the same circuit, in fact, this neuron comes from the secondary somatosensory cortex, you will see that the neurons are differential. But see, for example, the second stimulus is 26 here, and the second stimulus is 26, 18 and 18 here, but there are differences. One possibility is that they are driven by the motor response of the animal, but the other possibility is that the neurons are modulated by the first stimulus, by the history of the first stimulus. And if you do this analysis, you will see that this neuron is a comparison cell. So mathematically, this neuron is combining the first and the second stimulus. Some other cells do exactly the opposite, as it does this. And you will see that this neuron, for example, is differential. I'm plotting here the modulation as a function of the first stimulus. You will see that the distance between the two are a little bit different. So I always think that there is no a perfect comparison. Or is it matters more the second the sensory input, or matters more the working memory component. And in fact, when you plot this, you will see that this neuron is in between the first stimulus and between the comparison cell. And I matter why. If I do an analysis across time, the beginning of the second stimulus is here, you will see that this neuron first, when the second stimulus is delivered, is remembering information about the first, and then combines the second and touches the diagonal and then comes back. When we analyze information about cell from this monkey, it happens that this monkey was paying attention more to the first stimulus because he was scared. It was scared that he could forget information about the first to make the comparison about the second. Most of the neurons, for most of the monkeys, what they do is they go through the vertical axis, either here or here, and then turn to the diagonal. So this fellow did this. And always saw, and at the end, what matters is the comparison process. So this fellow solved the discrimination process. And with this technique, if I take one more minute, I will finish. I can go across different cortical circuits. This is the primary, secondary, ventral premotor cortex, prefrontal cortex, medial premotor cortex. And you will see from a very simple sensory representation, which is a pontotonic driving of the firing rate of the cells, transforms into a dual representation, so with positive and negative. And remember that these two antagonistic responses are important for doing a subtraction operation in which the fraction matters for the discrimination performance. This code states across these circuits. Of course, there are more circuits that we haven't studied, but it stays like this. And when this is gone, when the first stimulus is gone, the code states exactly the same for these areas. They keep the information when the stimulus is gone. But when the second stimulus comes, it's more complex, because then you have to decode information about the first, about the second. In the primary somatosensory cortex, you have, again, the modulatory action of the stimulus on the responses. But from here, from the secondary to the medial premotor cortex, where you have information about the first, the green dots, about the first, and a combination about the two. And all this is decoded during the 500 milliseconds. This code states for all the circuits, and even from the primary somatosensory, for the primary motor cortex, there are some decision signals that are superimposed to drive the motor response. Interestingly enough, is when you, for example, make the animal to produce exactly the same movements, but for example, you instruct the animal to press the medial or the lateral plus button, so these responses disappear. I have no more time, I think, but the decision signals, the signals, for example, if I take the signals from here, I can decode the discrimination performance, which matter in order to have a choice whether to press the medial or the lateral push button. And when this signal, for example, the two stimuli deliver, but instructed by the visual to press one of the two push buttons, these decision signals disappear. So the problem which stays for us is how the network gathers in order to produce decisions in a single trial, and Alexander Puget said yesterday. This is a posteriori reconstruction about the whole process, and right now what we're doing is recording simultaneously from different cortical areas as the monkey is performing the task, And of course, you can have the responses from different cells. And we've been doing this experiment for over the last 5 years and doing the analysis, and at the moment, we don't know how the cortical circuits interact in real time in one single trial in order to solve this simple discrimination task. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much for this nice overview. Since it's now time to introduce the chair of this session, I'm Leo van Hemmen, and it's my pleasure to guide the discussion through the cliffs of time. Let me see, who has the first question? Okay, take a minute because you'll get a microphone. By the way, who wants to pose the second question? Since people need a finite amount of time to give you the microphone. Yep.
So I was wondering, it is known from rats that they tend to encode a combination of amplitude and frequency with their firing rates in S1. And I was wondering if you had ever varied the amplitude to see if the neurons and or your monkeys would get confused if maybe you increase the frequency but reduce the amplitude at the same time.
We did that experiment many years ago. It was published in Nature in 1998 when we did the microstimulation experiment, and we were wondering whether it was not the amplitude of the current or the stimulus frequency, for example. We had some artifacts or something in the stimulus configuration that was used by the animals, for example, amplitude in order to discrimination. Yes, we did changes of 40% of the stimulus amplitude up and down, and the animal was able to do the frequency discrimination task. Remember, this stimulus is well above the discrimination, the detection threshold, which is about 7 times. The detection threshold is about 7 microns for 20 hertz. So if you have 20 hertz multiplied by 7, it's about 100 microns. So you can vary the amplitude from 140 or down to 60 or something like that. But the monkey is still able to do frequency discrimination, probably because it's fixed to frequency discrimination. If you shift it to amplitude, of course, it will be a discrimination amplitude task with no problem.
Further questions?
Can you tell us something about attention, the role of attention? What happens if you have a competing stimulus?
The only thing I can tell you is that the monkey is using full attention in order to do the task. We haven't done an attention experiment because the question for us was to describe the neural correlates across different circuits. But of course, it's a pending problem for us, how attention might affect the sensory processing, the working memory component, and the decision process. The most I can tell you is that if you deliver the stimuli in a very passive test in which you distract the animal, the responses in the primary somatosensory cortex stay as they are. But most of the processing is gone from secondary somatosensory cortex up to the frontal lobe. The neurons are no longer discriminating. So the monkey, because the monkey is not paying attention anymore to the stimuli. Even if you distract the animal with the visual test, those responses also disappear.
Have you looked at the effect of stimulus duration? Because that may also tell you something about coding.
Yeah, we did that experiment. If somebody is interested, there is a 2005 Nature Neuroscience paper in which we thought we could bias the discrimination performance just by making the stimulus longer than the for example, the first or the second, or shorter the first than the second one. Of course, there is a bias. There is an accumulation signal that is used, but very sensitive. In fact, what the monkey does is to pick information from the two and 150 milliseconds information about that. And a little bit more is enough to produce a bias. And below that filter, the neuron, the monkey tastes, for example, a higher stimulus that it were lower or something like that. So there's a very sensitive period of time in which the animal takes information in order to do the discrimination.
Okay, thank you very much.
Welcome.
Once again.
Thank you.